Chapter 138. That's a love. Ma likes it doubled. And now you must tell me, dearest Ma and Lavi, upon your words and honors. Didn't you for a moment, just a moment, think I was a dreadful little wretch, when I wrote to say I had run away? ... Before Mrs. Wilfer could wave her gloves, the mendicant stride in her merriest affectionate manner went on again. I think it must have made you rather cross, dear Ma and Lavi, and I know I deserved that you should be very cross. But you see I had been such a heedless, heartless creature, and had led you so to expect that I should marry for money, and so to make sure that I was incapable of marrying for love, that I thought you couldn't believe me. Because, you see, you didn't know how much of good, I had learned from John. Well, so I was sly about it, and ashamed of what you supposed me to be, and fearful that we couldn't understand one another, and might come to words, which we should all be sorry for afterwards. And so I said to John, that if he liked to take me without any fuss, he might. And as he did like, I let him. And we were married at Greenwich Church in the presence of nobody except an unknown individual who dropped in, ... her eyes sparkled more brightly, and half a pensioner. And now, isn't it nice, dearest Ma and Lavi, to know that no words have been said which any of us can be sorry for, and that we are all the best of friends at the pleasantest of teas? ... Having got up and kissed them again, she slipped back to her chair after a loop on the road, to squeeze her husband round the neck, and again went on. And now you will naturally want to know, dearest Ma and Lavi, how we live, and what we have got to live upon. Well, and so we live on Blackheath, in the charmingest of dolls' houses, delightfully furnished, and we have a clever little servant who is decidedly pretty, and we are economical and orderly, and do everything by clockwork, and we have £150 a year, and we have all we want, and more. And lastly, if you would like to know in confidence, as perhaps you may, what is my opinion of my husband, my opinion is that I almost love him. ... And if you would like to know in confidence, as perhaps you may, said her husband, smiling, as he stood by her side, without her having detected his approach, my opinion of my wife, my opinion is. ... But Bella started up, and put her hand upon his lips. Stop, sir. No, John, dear. Seriously. Please not yet a while. I want to be something, so much worthier than the doll in the doll's house. ... My darling, are you not? ... Not half, not a quarter, so much worthier as I hope you may someday find me. Try me through some reverse, John, try me through some trial, and tell him after that, what you think of me. ... I will, my life, said John. I promise it. ... That's my dear John. And you won't speak a word now, will you? ... And I won't, said John, with a very expressive look of admiration around him, speak a word now. ... She laid her laughing cheek upon his breast to thank him, and said, looking at the rest of them sideways out of her bright eyes. I'll go further, Pa and Ma and Lavi. John don't suspect it, he has no idea of it, but I quite love him. ... Even Mrs. Wilfer relaxed under the influence of her married daughter, and seemed in a majestic manner to imply remotely that, if R.W. had been a more deserving object, she too might have condescended to come down from her pedestal for his beguilement. Miss Lavinia, on the other hand, had strong doubts of the policy of the course of treatment, and whether it might not spoil Mr. Sampson, if experimented on in the case of that young gentleman. R.W. himself was for his part convinced that he was father of one of the most charming of girls, and that Rokesmith was the most favored of men, which opinion, if propounded to him, Rokesmith would probably not have contested. The newly married pair left early, so that they might walk at leisure to their starting place from London, for Greenwich. At first they were very cheerful and talked much, But after a while, Bella fancied that her husband was turning somewhat thoughtful. So she asked him, "John dear, what's the matter? Matter, my love? Won't you tell me?" said Bella, looking up into his face, "what you are thinking of. There's not much in the thought, my soul. I was thinking whether you wouldn't like me to be rich. You rich, John?" Repeated Bella, shrinking a little. "I mean, really rich. Say, as rich as Mr. Boffin. You would like that?" "I should be almost afraid to try, John dear. Was he much the better for his wealth? Was I much the better for the little part I once had in it?" "But all people are not the worse for riches, my own." "Most people?" Bella musingly suggested with raised eyebrows. "Nor even most people, it may be hoped. If you were rich, for instance, you would have a great power of doing good to others." "Yes, sir, for instance," Bella playfully rejoined. "But should I exercise the power, for instance? And again, sir, for instance, should I, at the same time, have a great power of doing harm to myself?" Laughing and pressing her arm, he retorted. "But still, again for instance, would you exercise that power?" "I don't know," said Bella, thoughtfully shaking her head. "I hope not. I think not. But it's so easy to hope not and think not, without the riches. Why don't you say, my darling, instead of that phrase, being poor?" He asked, looking earnestly at her. "Why don't I say, being poor?" "Because I am not poor. Dear John, it's not possible that you suppose I think we are poor?" "I do, my love." "Oh John. Understand me, sweetheart. I know that I am rich beyond all wealth in having you, but I think of you, and think for you. In such a dress as you are wearing now, you first charmed me, and in no dress could you ever look, to my thinking, more graceful or more beautiful. But you have admired many finer dresses this very day, and is it not natural that I wish I could give them to you?" "It's very nice that you should wish it, John. It brings these tears of grateful pleasure into my eyes to hear you say so with such tenderness. But I don't want them." He pursued, "we are now walking through the muddy streets. I love those pretty feet so dearly that I feel as if I could not bear the dirt to soil the sole of your shoe. Is it not natural that I wish you could ride in a carriage?" "It's very nice," said Bella, glancing downward at the feet in question, "to know that you admire them so much, John dear, and since you do, I am sorry that these shoes are a full size too large. But I don't want a carriage, believe me." "You would like one, if you could have one, Bella?" "I shouldn't like it for its own sake, half so well as such a wish for it. Dear John, your wishes are as real to me as the wishes in the fairy story, that were all fulfilled, as soon as spoken. Wish me everything that you can wish for the woman you dearly love, and I have as good as got it, John. I have better than got it, John." They were not the less happy for such talk, and home was not the less home for coming after it. Bella was fast developing a perfect genius for home. All the loves and graces seemed, her husband thought, to have taken domestic service with her, and to help her to make home engaging. Her married life glided happily on. She was alone all day, for, after an early breakfast, her husband repaired every morning to the city, and did not return until their late dinner hour. He was in the China House, he explained to Bella, which he found quite satisfactory, without pursuing the China House in 2 minuter details than a wholesale vision of tea, rice, odd-smelling silks, carved boxes, and tie-dyed people in more than double-soled shoes, with their pigtails pulling their heads of hair off, painted on transparent porcelain. She always walked with her husband to the railroad, and was always there again to meet him. Her old coquettish ways a little sobered down, but not much, and her dress as daintily managed, as if she managed nothing else. But, John gone to business and Bella returned home, the dress would be laid aside, trim little wrappers and aprons would be substituted, and Bella, putting back her hair with both hands, as if she were making the most business-like arrangements for going dramatically distracted, would enter on the household affairs of the day. Such weighing and mixing and chopping and grating, such dusting and washing and polishing, such snipping and weeding and trowelling, and other small gardening, such making and mending and folding and airing, such diverse arrangements, and above all such severe study. For Mrs. J.R., who had never been wont to do too much at home as Miss B.W., was under the constant necessity of referring for advice and support to a sage volume entitled The Complete British Family Housewife, which she would sit consulting, with her elbows on the table and her temples on her hands, like some perplexed enchantress poring over the black art. This, principally because The Complete British Housewife, however sound a Briton at heart, was by no means an expert Briton at expressing herself with clearness in the British tongue, and sometimes might have issued her directions to equal purpose in the Kamskatchan language. In any crisis of this nature, Bella would suddenly exclaim aloud, "Oh, you ridiculous old thing, what do you mean by that? You must have been drinking." Apostrophe and having made this marginal note, would try the housewife again, with all her dimples screwed into an expression of profound research. There was likewise a coolness on the part of the British housewife, which Mrs. John Rokesmith found highly exasperating. She would say, "Take a salamander," apostrophe as if a general should command a private to catch a tartar. Or, she would casually issue the order, throw in a handful apostrophe of something entirely unattainable. In these, the housewife's most glaring moments of unreason, Bella would shut her up, and knock her on the table, apostrophizing her with the compliment, "Oh, you are a stupid old donkey. Where am I to get it, do you think?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, another branch of study claimed the attention of Mrs. John Rokesmith for a regular period every day. This was the mastering of the newspaper, so that she might be close up with John on general topics when John came home. In her desire to be in all things his companion, she would have set herself with equal zeal to master algebra, or Euclid, if he had divided his soul between her and either. Wonderful was the way in which she would store up the city intelligence, and beamingly shed it upon John in the course of the evening, incidentally mentioning the commodities that were looking up in the markets, and how much gold had been taken to the bank, and trying to look wise and serious over it until she would laugh at herself most charmingly and would say, kissing him, "It all comes of my love, John dear." Apostrophe, for a city man, John certainly did appear to care as little as might be for the looking up or looking down of things, as well as for the gold that got taken to the bank. But he cared, beyond all expression, for his wife, as a most precious and sweet commodity that was always looking up, and that never was worth less than all the gold in the world. And she, being inspired by her affection, and having a quick wit and a fine ready instinct, made amazing progress in her domestic efficiency, though, as an endearing creature, she made no progress at all. This was her husband's verdict, and he justified it by telling her that she had begun her married life as the most endearing creature that could possibly be. "And you have such a cheerful spirit," apostrophe, apostrophe, he said, fondly. "You are like a bright light in the house." Apostrophe, "Am I truly, John?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Are you truly?" "Yes, indeed. Only much more, and much better." Apostrophe, "Do you know, John dear," apostrophe, said Bella, taking him by a button of his coat, "that I sometimes, at odd moments, don't laugh, John, please. apostrophe, nothing should induce John to do it, when she asked him not to do it. Apostrophe that I sometimes think, John, I feel a little serious. Apostrophe, are you too much alone, my darling? Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh dear, no, John. The time is so short, that I have not a moment too much in the week. Apostrophe, why serious, my life, then? When serious? Apostrophe, when I laugh, I think, apostrophe, said Bella, laughing as she laid her head upon his shoulder. You wouldn't believe, sir, that I feel serious now? But I do. Apostrophe, and she laughed again, and something glistened in her eyes. Would you like to be rich, pet? Apostrophe, apostrophe, he asked her coaxingly. Rich, John? How can you ask such goose's questions? Apostrophe, do you regret anything, my love? Apostrophe, apostrophe, regret anything? No. Apostrophe, Bella confidently answered. But then, suddenly changing, she said, between laughing and glistening, oh yes, I do though. I regret Mrs. Boffin. Apostrophe, I too, regret that separation very much. But perhaps it is only temporary. Perhaps things may so fall out, as that you may sometimes see her again, as that we may sometimes see her again. Apostrophe, Bella might be very anxious on the subject, but she scarcely seemed so at the moment. With an absent air, she was investigating that button on her husband's coat when Pa came in to spend the evening. Pa had his special chair and his special corner reserved for him on all occasions, and without disparagement of his domestic joys, was far happier there than anywhere. It was always pleasantly droll to see Pa and Bella together, but on this present evening her husband thought her more than usually fantastic with him. You are a very good little boy, apostrophe said Bella, to come unexpectedly, as soon as you could get out of school. And how have they used you at school today, you dear? Apostrophe, apostrophe, well, my pet, apostrophe replied the cherub, smiling and rubbing his hands as she sat him down in his chair, I attend two schools. There's the Mincing Lane establishment, and there's your mother's academy. Which might you mean, my dear? Apostrophe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.